find all sorts of opinions and add your own at the Radio National website.
Hello and welcome to Big Ideas on RN and online at abc.net.au/RN. I'm Paul Barclay. Thanks for joining me. Tonight, the second of this year's Boyer Lectures, The Promise of Science, A Vision of Hope. And I'll throw straight to RN's Robin Williams to introduce our speaker, Professor Suzanne Corey.
Hello, I'm Robin Williams and welcome to the 2014 Boyer Lectures. In her last lecture, Professor Suzanne Corey, former director of the Walter and Eliza Hall Institute in Melbourne, talked of her early career and how she enjoyed the brilliant leadership of legends such as Francis Crick and Fred Sanger, who had three Nobel Prizes between them. This time she shows how extraordinarily important scientific R&D is for our economy. Which manufacturing industry, for instance, do you imagine leads Australian exports in recent times? Well, the answer, surprising to some, is medical technology. All those apnea machines, vaccines and bionic devices. The fascination of these lectures is the way Professor Corey reflects on her own life and family, talking personally and movingly, and then shows how the science for which she has such a passion is the very basis of our future. So here is Suzanne Corey, the first woman to be elected President of the Australian Academy of Science, with her second Boyer lecture, Science for a Healthy Economy.
When I first sat down at my desk to think about these lectures, my 18-month-old granddaughter Lyra came into the room and started gleefully rifling through the books. Her presence made me think about what her world will be like in the decades to come. I mused about my own life and started to think about what I want hers to be. Many of my hopes and fears for Lyra are undoubtedly shared by you. So what do we need to do in Australia today to secure health and prosperity for our children and grandchildren tomorrow? I've had a privileged life. I grew up in Melbourne in a family rich in love, although not money. And my brother, sister and I received an excellent education in government schools. My father was an accountant by day, mended our school shoes in the garage at night, and built us a beach shack with his own hands. My mother looked after us all and served the local community. Although the long shadow of World War II and Korea still lingered, its impact was muted by the oceans that separate Australia from the rest of the world. We walked or rode our bikes to school without fear. And our family camping holidays gave us a deep and lifelong affinity with the Australian bush and deserts and beaches. I was born a feminist and I grew up convinced that girls can do anything. As a child, my aspirations ranged from being a novelist to becoming an astronaut. But instead, inspired by a wonderful high school teacher, I became a scientist. In 1961, I went to the University of Melbourne on a Commonwealth scholarship, fulfilling a dream denied to my parents by the Depression. I did my PhD at Cambridge, actually supported by a British scholarship because the few Australian scholarships available at that time were explicitly restricted to males. My time in Cambridge at the world-famous MRC Laboratory of Molecular Biology taught me that science is a vocation, not a job. And there too, I met my wonderful partner in life and science, Gerry Adams. Later, Gerry and I set up our own lab back in Melbourne at the Walter and Eliza Hall Institute of Medical Research. And we've worked there ever since. This world-famous research centre enabled us to compete in science at the highest level, while raising our two daughters in Australia within the loving embrace of my extended family. What have I learned from my own story to want for Lyra? What I want most for her is to enjoy good health and a happy family life. I also want her to have an excellent education and attain the full potential of her talents. I want her to have a high-quality, fulfilling job that she enjoys, to be able to wake up every morning wanting to go to work, like I still do after 45 years in the lab. and I want her to have the leisure time and income to develop broad interests and activities. I want Lyra's Australia to be peaceful and tolerant, rich in science and the arts, with a strong commitment to social equity and cohesion. I want her nation to be exciting, vibrant and innovative. I want the cities to be visually beautiful, full of trees and parks. I want her to be able to experience unspoiled natural wilderness throughout the continent. And I want her to feel proud that Australia is a good global citizen. But in my gloomy moments, I worry that my vision for Lyra is unattainable. In the recent past, Australia has provided a secure, prosperous life for most of its people, although shamefully, we continue to leave many behind. Our rich natural resources have enabled us to supply the burgeoning needs of China and other countries in our region, and buffered us against the economic downturns experienced recently by many other nations. We enjoy access to abundant fresh food and water, spacious housing, good health care and quality education. And our average wages have increased steadily over the past 20 years. They're now 37% higher in real terms than they were in 1994. But as I gaze towards Lyra's future, there is certainly no guarantee that Australia will continue to prosper or that we'll be able to improve the lives of our less fortunate citizens. Indeed, it seems to me that Australia is at a tipping point. The possibility that we could slide seriously backwards was brought into sharp focus by the recent collapse of the automotive industry. Australia's traditional manufacturing sector lost 87,000 jobs in the last 5 years and is projected to lose another 40,000 in the next five. Experts also forecast a net loss of more than 12,000 mining jobs in the next 5 years as China's demand for resources slows down. And our vast backyard quarry is diminishing. Discovery of new deposits have not kept pace with depletion, despite the significant effort that's gone into exploration. Even though we fondly believe we're an egalitarian society, this is rapidly becoming a myth, threatening our social cohesion. Income inequalities are now at 19th century levels in many developed countries, and Australia's income disparity is trending in the same direction. The government's recent austerity measures will hit the economically disadvantaged hard and further deepen the social divide. Australia's population is growing at one of the fastest rates of any nation, 1.5% per year on average. And I can't resist adding that boat arrivals are only a tiny proportion of this. By 2061, our population is projected to be somewhere between 37 million and 48 million. While this growth will bring opportunities, it will also bring challenges for our environmental and urban sustainability and for our food and water resources. And the ageing demographic will challenge our social and health system. Climate change is also imposing increasing stress. Droughts, bushfires and floods are forecast to increase in frequency and intensity, imposing huge economic, cultural and ecological costs. Maintaining our quality of life in the face of these and other challenges will depend on many factors, including, very crucially, ongoing economic prosperity. It's simply not an option to hang on and hope that circumstances will change. We must actively fashion our own circumstances. As economist Don Russell, former Secretary of the Department of Innovation and Science, urged in his recent Crawford Reflections lecture, and I paraphrase, we must become the country of economic transformation. How are we going to achieve this economic transformation? In my view, this will be crucially dependent on investment in research, innovation, and education. It may seem counterintuitive, but our resource riches have actually hindered us from becoming sufficiently innovative and competitive. Many of the countries that are now the strongest economically lack huge natural resources. They've become strong by investing in their people, in education, and in science. Denmark, Korea, Singapore and Japan are good examples. Australia must learn from these success stories. Currently, almost all of our new technology comes from somewhere else. Only 2% of the new technologies used by Australian firms have been developed here. 2%. A recent report from Australia's Council of Learned Academies stresses the urgent need to ramp up our own innovation capacity. Time is not on our side, it warns. In the past 10 years, other countries have moved ahead of us. And although we'll continue to profit from our natural resources, from mining, agriculture, and tourism, we must add more value before sending our wares offshore. And although our service sector has grown handsomely and created many jobs, we also need to make things, patent ideas, produce high-quality products and services that are highly sought after by the world's markets. We must progress from traditional to advanced manufacturing. We must incorporate innovative technologies, materials and processes into product design, production and marketing. We have the talent to do this, aided by our scientists. In the last lecture, I spoke about some of Australia's economic success stories in medicine and medical technology. There are many others. Tomorrow morning, when you put on your glasses or pop in disposable contact lenses, you can thank Australian scientists. And soon the hope is for a bionic eye that will restore sight to the blind. Every time you use cash, you're paying with long-lasting and unforgeable polymer banknotes developed by David Solomon and Ezio Rizzardo at CSIRO. You'll also find their advanced polymers in paints, lubricants and adhesives. And soon you'll be able to charge your social media devices as you walk, because your clothing will have flexible solar cells sewn into it, thanks to discoveries by Professor Andrew Holmes. These are great stories, and there are many more. But unless our government and businesses urgently invest more in research and development, we simply will not sustain this kind of success. The brightest people will head overseas, where they'll find willing investors and developers. In actual fact, Australia's total investment in R&D is below the OECD average and lags well behind that of the leaders, Israel, Finland and Korea. Investment in science, research and innovation by the Australian government has actually fallen for the last 2 years. In 2011-12, it invested $9.1 billion, but by the end of the last financial year, this had dropped by 5% to only $8.6 billion. This is extremely short-sighted. At the very least, our investment should be on a par with the OECD average, with the aim to exceed it, and soon. And it must be consistent and long-term. Frequent changes in government policy and stop-start support undermines confidence and inhibits the risk-taking required for step change. Equally important as strong investment in research and development is strong support for education, because the education of our future workforce is absolutely vital if we want to transform our economy. Many of the jobs our children and grandchildren will have when they leave school and university do not yet exist. Indeed, we cannot even imagine what they might be. But we can say with absolute certainty that many of the new well-paid jobs will emerge from or depend upon science and technology. Already the trend is clear. Over the next 5 years, more than 88,000 new jobs will be created in the professional, scientific and technical area. Even for non-scientists and non-technologists, a sound science education will be essential, because our leaders and citizens must be able to operate effectively within a technologically advanced world. It follows that science, maths and engineering will need to be a major focus in our education system, arguably the major focus. President Obama is acutely aware of the importance of science to the economy and international competitiveness, remarking, and I quote, We know that the nation that goes all in on innovation today will own the global economy tomorrow. Accordingly, he has set as a national goal that American students should move from the middle to the top of the international pack in science and maths over the next decade. Unfortunately, the story is very different in Australia. Our performance in science and maths education is failing, while that of our Asian rivals is surging ahead. 2012 figures show that Australian teenagers performed worse in science than their peers in China, Singapore, Japan, Finland, Estonia, and Korea. In fact, the difference between students in Australia and those in Shanghai amounts to almost 2 years of schooling. In maths, the picture is even worse, with 16 countries scoring higher than Australia. Again, Shanghai scored the highest, and in this case, the difference was just over 3 years of schooling. This decline is of grave concern because mathematics is an enabling science. Without maths, it's not possible to make use of other sciences, either in the lab or in the workforce. As my friend and great Australian mathematician Nalini Joshi reminds us, and I quote, "The pathway towards economic diversity and opportunity is paved with mathematics. Mathematics can show us how to minimise traffic snarls in our cities, cut costs in a complex network of rail transportation, avoid congestion on the internet, weigh costs and benefits of environmental policies, and optimise a small business plan." What is the cause of this declining interest of Australian students in science and maths? Why do teens lose that burning spirit of inquiry that drives them as young children? Every scientist I know has a story about the teacher who first inspired them. We need to nurture such teachers more effectively and produce more of them. We must value them more highly, and we must pay them accordingly. But the reality is that most Australian primary teachers have not studied science, and therefore they lack confidence in teaching science. And even in our secondary schools, science and maths is often taught by teachers with poor training in these areas. Perhaps because of this, traditional chalk and talk teaching, copying notes and cookbook practical lessons are still far too prevalent. Anybody with a teenager in their lives knows that such an approach holds little appeal. Social media and internet games habituate them to high engagement and instant feedback. New education programs developed for primary and junior secondary school by the Australian Academy of Science are beginning to turn the tide. These programs do away with chalk and talk entirely and emphasise teaching science through hands-on inquiry. Both are fully aligned with the national curriculum, and they're highly effective in keeping students engaged and improving their learning. To me, nothing is more important for Australia than providing every child with the best education we can afford. Our children and our grandchildren deserve nothing less. I saw firsthand at my government school how high-quality education enabled the children of poor immigrant families to become leaders in our society in just one generation. As a nation, the vast bulk of our education dollar should be used to address inequity in education and make quality education available for every Australian child, rather than for further enhancing infrastructure in wealthy private schools. The recommendations for education reform made by David Gonski displayed great vision. We must not let this vision wither, as now seems to be happening. Equally, we must not allow increased university fees and hex changes to discourage or prevent our brightest young people from obtaining high-quality tertiary education. Moving from transforming our workforce to transforming the economy, how should Australia be planning for knowledge and innovation-based industries? Sometimes the breakthroughs that drive innovation can be planned for, but more often they develop unexpectedly from blue sky research, the kind of research that's done purely for the sake of discovery. 50 years on, The awesome accomplishments of the Apollo program still seem like Star Wars science fiction. But the spin-off partnerships between NASA and industry yielded countless innovations we use every day. Innovations like building insulation, sports textiles, water purification, and freeze-dried food, to mention just a few. The Human Genome Project, too, began as a voyage of pure discovery to map and sequence all our genes. But the knowledge and technology that it has spawned has transformed pharmaceutical, diagnostic, agricultural, and many other industries. For every dollar invested, the project has already returned more than $65 to the US economy. A whopping $965 billion in total. And while that phenomenal rate of return is sinking in, I'd like you to take a moment to imagine a world without Wi-Fi. A world without Wi-Fi? Teens around the nation would shudder at the thought. Many of you may not realise it, but Wi-Fi is a great Australian example of a transforming technology that developed from blue sky research. The story began in 1977 when John O'Sullivan and his CSIRO colleagues published a paper about improving the clarity of their radio telescope images. In the 90s, the team adapted this method to reduce interference for radio signals. And now their technology is embedded in millions of computers, phones, cameras, tablets, and games. We use Wi-Fi-enabled devices every day, and we're addicted to them. The former UK Minister for Universities and Science, David Willetts, has spoken compellingly about government's role in stimulating fundamental cutting-edge research to transform industry. His vision is for the UK to become the world's best R&D lab, and he's chosen eight areas for major new investment: big data, space, robotics and autonomous systems, synthetic biology, regenerative medicine, agri-science, advanced materials, and energy. What about us? Which areas of Australian science could propel us forward? Well, medical research, astronomy, physics, chemistry, and robotics, for a start. Astronomy has already spawned the most exciting and challenging mega science program that Australia's ever been involved in, the Square Kilometre Array, or SKA. This is a project that offers huge opportunities, not only to our astronomers and astrophysicists, but also to many of our industries. I'm sure you've seen, or at least heard of, the iconic Australian movie The Dish, which brought radio telescopes into our popular culture, telling how the Parkes Dish in New South Wales relayed humankind's first steps on the moon to televisions across the world. Well, the SKA is to the Parkes radio telescope as the smartphone is to the oldest dial phone. It's a gigantic $2.2 billion radio telescope, with a receiving surface of 1 million square metres. Hundreds of small antennae distributed over several thousand kilometres will act together as a single giant telescope that has spectacular resolution. The SKA will be located in the radio quiet deserts of Western Australia and South Africa, with an unparalleled view of the Milky Way. Construction will begin in 2 years, and it's being funded jointly by 9 countries, including, of course, Australia. There's never been anything like this. By giving scientists the ability to see much further across the universe than ever before, and in greater detail, this amazing instrument will allow us to look back in time. It will enable us to explore the origin and history of the universe, illuminate the mysterious nature of dark matter and dark energy, and learn more about black holes and cosmic radiation. The scale of the SKA is truly mind-blowing. Humanity is estimated to have spoken 5 million words in its entire history. But the SKA will collect the equivalent amount of information in just its first week of operation. Indeed, the dishes will produce 10 times the data of current global internet traffic and use enough optical fibre to wrap twice around the Earth. The impact of the SKA will extend well beyond astrophysics. It will provide hundreds of high-value jobs, both on-site and in diverse supporting industries. It'll revolutionise communication and information technology, because the means to handle the huge volumes of data from that desert network does not yet exist. So the project will push scientists and engineers to improve signal processing, storage and computation, as well as sensor technology. It'll also drive major innovation in wireless communication. The SKA has set itself the ambitious challenge of running on 100% locally generated renewable energy. And striving to achieve this goal will accelerate developments in generating and storing green power and bring new and improved methods for distributing that power. Two precursor facilities have already been built in the desert, 800 kilometres north of Perth. CSIRO's Australian SKA Pathfinder, or ASCAP, and the Murchison Wide Field Array, belonging to an international consortium of universities. These projects are already providing jobs, harvesting information about the universe, and creating new knowledge. In concluding, our achievements of the past, our Wi-Fi, our medical breakthroughs, our plastics technology, make me proud to be an Australian scientist. And projects like the SKA make me very excited about the future of Australian science and technology. We have so much potential. We have the knowledge and the drive to transform Australia into a vibrant, innovative, responsive, and resilient economy. With strong support for education, scientific infrastructure, research and development, Australia can be the kind of nation that I dream of for Lyra and for all of our children and grandchildren.
So it's R&D or RIP. Professor Suzanne Cory is a former president of the Australian Academy of Science. Next time, in her third Boyer lecture, she talks about our environment.
The era of change that is upon us now is not due to natural causes. It's of our making. Humankind is fouling the nest.
Suzanne Cory and the Boyer Lectures, and the book of this lecture series, is available at the ABC shops now. You're on RN, I'm Robin Williams.
That was the second of this year's Boyer Lectures. This is Big Ideas on RN with me, Paul Barclay. Now we turn to the price of energy in Australia. Since 2006, the average household power bill has risen 85%, from $890 to $1,660 a year. For some of you, the bills have increased even more steeply. But according to some energy experts, the prices we pay are also unfair. Some people are paying too much, others too little. The reason is our energy networks. There's little incentive for you to use the network efficiently or for network companies to invest efficiently. Tony Wood, the Energy Program Director at the Grattan Institute, and Fran Kelly, host of RN Breakfast, discuss solutions to address this problem.
Tony, in this latest report, the Grattan Institute has really gone on the hunt for the formula to come up with fairer pricing for power. That's the holy grail, because power bills have been on an incredibly sharp rise in this country. But is it unfair, and what's unfair about the way power is priced here now?
I guess this particular piece of work, Fran, arose from a previous analysis we'd done on the way networks have been priced and the way they've been growing. And there were three things that came out of that. One is that the way the regulatory structure puts pressure on the businesses to continue to invest, the way the businesses get returns under that regulated structure, and the way the industry, the businesses, the regulatory bodies just didn't see the change in demand, that is demand falling, all meant that we had some interesting problems. One is the regulatory structure needed to be addressed, and there are things being done, and both at a state and a federal level, and that we'd have to be a little optimistic that some of those price increases we've seen in the last 4 or 5 years may start to at least ameliorate. We'll see if they can actually come down a bit, but at least they should. We shouldn't see those same increases. The second thing was, if we have built too much, then what do we do about that? Who's going to pay for the assets we don't need anymore, or that what we probably didn't need in the first place, if they were, as some people have described, gold-plated? And that's a separate piece of work we may come back to, because it's quite a tricky problem. The third thing was, the way we're pricing these networks is itself causing a difficulty because we don't have the right structure. And so when you look at 40-odd percent, depending on where you are in Australia, 40-odd percent of the total electricity bill is in the networks. The way those networks charge for what they do, which is to transport electricity from generators to homes and businesses through wires and poles, is basically causing incentives that are skewed towards the wrong sorts of behaviour. And the example that I'll give in terms of the fairness question is, if you're somebody who has puts in place a large air conditioner, for example, and this is not against air conditioning point, but if you're somebody who puts in a large air conditioner, you actually may not use that much more electricity, particularly if you only use it at peak times of the day. You come home on a hot day, you stick it on, and it draws an awful lot of power. Problem is, when you do that, a lot of other people are doing the same thing, so you get this enormous spike in electricity demand, and then it comes down again and so forth, right? So what happens is you put a very significant load on that network. The network businesses have been obliged, because of the way they structured and regulated, to keep building to meet that peak demand. That is, to meet the AFL Grand Final day when 110,000 people want to get into the stadium. The problem is they don't charge that way, so when this happens, the person who is invested in this large air conditioner ends up effectively imposing a significant load on the network, which has to be built for, but then it's only used for a couple of, for only 10, 20, 30 hours a year, and it's left idle the rest of the time. Question was, and this is a very long answer to your initial question, Van, the question is that fair when everybody else effectively, who isn't necessarily putting in a big air conditioner, isn't using electricity that way?
So there's a few elements to that answer. One is the point that we have the gold-plated or all that billions of dollars spent on the poles and wires and a lot of intense increase in that capacity over the last 5 years because all those people with big air conditioners are turning them in at once. So to cope with that hour of, you know, every day for however many weeks a year it is. So the networks had to do that because if they didn't, then the grid would be overloaded and we'd have blackouts. So they've done that, and then they had to charge all of us for it. What you're looking at here is the way they charge, and you've come up with some new ideas on how they could do that more fairly. So those people, if you like, to keep the analogy going, without air conditioners, don't pay for all the people with air conditioners. And the first notion you've come up with is a capacity charge. Can you explain what that would be, how that would work?
Well, the idea is that instead of being charged for the amount of electricity we put through the wires, which may, for some people, be reasonably steady over the day and across the year, and other people might be very peaky, you actually charge for the network on the basis of how much of that network you want. That is, if I want to be able to use a lot of electricity for a short period of time, such as at peak times, I should pay for a bigger chunk of the network than somebody who uses maybe the same amount of electricity over the whole year, but it uses it over a more steady period. So the idea is that what you'd say to people is, look, the companies can do this, look at the way you've used electricity over the last year, maybe, I mean, you wouldn't penalise somebody because they had one really bad day.
I was just going to say, right? I mean, how is that fair if, you know, the analogy we've talked about, you're having a home wedding and you've got the band playing and you've got the catering ovens on and you've got the lights on and the disco balls and all of that, that's going to be a really big demand for that day. It would be unfair to charge you, to base your per unit charge on that day. So how do you work out what's fair?
Well, then you're trying to balance things. I mean, because if everybody else was having their party with their band and their et cetera on the same day, of course that would be a problem, but it doesn't work that way, right? Mostly the time it's a bit more even than that. So the idea would be to say, well, look, we'll look at, say, the top 5 days across the year in which you use the maximum amount of electricity. What were the top 5 points? Average that. That would then become effectively the quarterly charge for your electricity for the next year. And what that would mean is that instead of paying, as I said, for the amount of electricity, you would simply pay that amount, a quarter of that amount, allocated to everybody evenly based upon your that peak demand. And in addition to that, of course, you know, if you had two people who used exactly the same shape of electricity, but one used twice as much as the other, they would still pay twice as much. But you'd actually be paying for the size of the pipe, if you like, or the amount of the network that you actually need. It's a bit like the way mobile phones are charged. You pay for the bandwidth of the gigabytes you want to bring down the line. If you spend all your time downloading movies, you need a very big pipe. If you only spend a little bit of time on the internet and looking at emails, for example, you need a small pipe.
I'm not sure if you've got it. I'm not sure if I've got it. Are you saying then that if we have those at least five high usage times, then our per unit cost across the year for power is higher than somebody who doesn't ever have that kind of peak usage?
Yeah, basically. So what would happen is that those people who do put a large demand on the network would pay more, and those who don't would pay less. The network itself would not have any change in the total revenue they connect from all of us.
But if I'm always energy wise, I pay cheaper electricity.
Correct. At the moment, someone who is maybe on low income, pensioner, stay at home, whatever, and your electricity is reasonably flat. So you might use, say, 6,000 kilowatt hours a year. If I'm in a house with a couple of kids and my wife and I both work, I might still use 6,000 kilowatt hours a year, but I use it a lot at peak times. Effectively, you are subsidising me at the moment. That's where it's unfair. You're effectively paying for the size of that pipe that I need at peak times. And if we changed it, you would pay less, and that would be clearly a more fair system because you're putting less load on the system.
And the benefit of doing that is not just that it's fairer, but also would it take pressure off the grid, because we'd all be trying to keep our peak use down to keep our unit charge lower.
We all respond to prices. If we had a price signal that says avoid using lots of electricity at peak times, then we would respond to that as well. We would change our behaviour. End result would be, not only would it be fairer, but over time, the networks wouldn't have to build as much because we all would be putting less pressure on the network. And once we did that, the cost would start to come down. Now, that wouldn't happen overnight, but the first bit would happen overnight. The fairness bit, where people who are being unfairly penalised because they're using even amounts of electricity, they would get that benefit immediately.
There is another, and it goes to that price signal thing, another element of your fairer pricing plan called critical peak pricing. The news headline out of this report says that could see people paying 700% more for their power at times.
It takes a little bit of unpacking, but once you get it, I think it's reasonably clear. And that is that at certain parts of the network, it's a bit like the freeway. The freeways, or even the MCG might even again be a better example, that really there's only a couple of days a year when the MCG is absolutely full. And in that day, of course, the MCG, the AFL Grand Final, we all know you pay a lot more for a ticket on that day. Well, in some ways, what we're talking about is critical peak pricing to do the same thing. The reason this is important is because there are parts of the network which are currently constrained, parts that are not. For the parts that are constrained, under the old system, basically the companies would simply meet that constraint by building some more assets, and everyone would pay for that. What we're suggesting, and there are people who have been proposing similar sort of concepts, is that the businesses would be asked by the regulator to demonstrate, and would be required of them to demonstrate, that they've thought about other possibilities. So, for example, have they thought about introducing critical peak pricing? And the idea of critical peak pricing is to say, in that part of the network that's constrained, we will offer what's called a critical peak price. And we know that, as I said, the network is really only used at those peak times, say, within 5% of the absolute peak for only 30 or 40 hours a year. And we know that only occurs over a very small number of days. Depending on where you are in Australia, the peak demand is really only reached even within 5% of that peak, maybe 10 days a year. So the deal would be is that for 355 days of the year, you'd be given a cheaper price. For 10 days of the year, your price would be higher, but only even then for those peak times of those days. So you would be given that information. In addition to that, ahead of that day, because the companies can't predict 12 months in advance, but they would know within a week, because most of this is driven by the weather. You'd be given information. Maybe it would be a SMS message. Maybe it could even be, as they do in France, over the weather forecast the night before. You'd be given information to say tomorrow is one of these, is a critical peak day, and the electricity that you use between, say, 2 p.m. and 8 p.m. will be eight times as much as it normally would be, six to eight times as much. Now, that is a very sharp price signal. And the reason you do that is because what you're trying to do is give people a really strong incentive to do what they can to reduce their electricity in those time periods.
So being human, the normal response to that would be, oh, okay, between 2 and 8, I'll turn off the washing machine and I won't use the dishwasher until later in the night and things like that. So to minimise their usage, because every unit they use is 7 or 8 times more.
And it is interesting that
you mentioned France.
Yes.
And I think in France this system is called the red, white and blue system. And on the weather forecast, the night before on the telly, they say tomorrow is a red day between these hours. Does it work? Has it worked? Have they documented it? It actually has.
The interesting thing about this, it can sound, from those of us who've been used to the way we price electricity in this country up until now, it sounds quite unusual and quite challenging. But in fact, the evidence is that when these sorts of pricing mechanisms are put in place, people do respond. And as a result of this, in companies like France, they've reduced their total demand, their total peak demand, significantly by 10 to 20%. And that means, as a result of that, the network businesses no longer have to keep investing at the same rate. Everyone benefits because that investment's avoided, and we all pay lower prices. And that's why you could start to see some slowing down of what have we have seen before, as you described, those nasty price increases.
So is your, when you approach this issue, was your goal cheaper power prices or less energy use?
Look, I don't think, we're not trying to penalise people for using energy. What we're trying to give people is the pricing signals under which people would then exercise choices to use energy efficiently and to use the networks efficiently. So if someone still wants to buy, if someone wants to, you know, go to the grand final on that day of the year, they'll pay the high price for the ticket. Other people will choose to watch it on television, or they don't want to watch football anyway. In this particular case, you give people choices. If there are people who do want to run their air conditioner and watch television and run the dishwasher, washing machine, everything else for those days, that's fine. So it's not to stop people exercising choices, it's to actually give people the pricing signals so that the choices they make are not only in their best interests, but in the best interests of the whole system. And once they do that, that can only be a good thing, I would suggest.
We do have a few questions in hand that people have sent in before tonight, and I'll go to one of those now, which was, how can we get greater investment in greater power efficiency? Because I think that is sort of what we're talking about, isn't it? Taking the pressure off the grid is and getting us cheaper and fairer pricing along the way.
Yeah, well, I think the system we have today is inefficient. So what we've been doing is a result of not giving people pricing, not telling people, look, by using electricity the way we have been, responding to the lack of good prices, we've been actually building an inefficient system, and we're all paying for that. By sending different pricing signals to people, they change. And it sounds a bit, you know, economic, you know, tech talk in a sense, but we actually do respond to prices, and much more so than we respond to pleas to behave better.
So it's an incentive to use less energy. That's what it is, isn't it?
Well, in this particular case, we're talking about using less of the network. If you use the same amount of energy, say, for example, you still run your washing machine, but you run it at
You use
late
less peak
morning.
Energy.
Yeah, so you just avoid using it at the peak time. Use less energy at the peak time. And there's lots of things we can do in our lives to change how much peak energy we use.
So to go to that question from the floor, greater investment in greater power efficiency, presumably for this all to work, we all need to understand it. Therefore, we need some kind of way of understanding when and how to use our energy. Is that where smart meters come in?
Partly, indeed. And without smarter meters, what we're talking about is much more difficult to achieve. In Victoria, we've had the experience of smart meters being rolled out. Most of us, probably in this room, have now what's called a smart meter. Many of us would have remembered when these things were put in, it was done very poorly, it was communicated very badly, and as a result, many people got the wrong idea of what this was all about. In fact, many people were so worried about it that they actually physically stopped the companies putting the meters into their houses. For most people, those meters are now in place. Unfortunately, because of the experience, we haven't been using them. But the problem is that we haven't yet, because the previous government, the Labor government as it was, the program they implemented was very poorly done. Mm. We all got very negative about these meters. We spent the money, we're not getting the benefit of them.
But they're still there. They have the capacity, yes, to allow the networks and the retailers to do, and us, to do what you're talking about.
Because now what we can do with those meters, the companies can measure not just how much electricity we use, but when we used it. Previously, the meter would be read once every 3 months, 3 or 4 months, and it would just take the difference between today's reading, what it was 3 months ago, what's the difference, there's your electricity bill. Now you can actually use that much more cleverly. The retailers will be able to use that information to structure pricing arrangements, which will be at least as attractive as what I'm talking about, and possibly even more so. I mean, what you should get is much greater innovation.
Give me an example of what an innovative retailer might do using the smart meter as it currently exists or in this future that you envisage.
Well, there's lots of technology. The meters themselves should only be an enabler of technology. This can sound a little bit spooky, but, you know, from next year, most air conditioners will be required to be able to be controlled remotely. That means that you could agree, it wouldn't be imposed upon you, you could agree with your power supplier that you would sign up to a deal in which your air conditioner could be what's called cycled. That is, that they could basically turn it off for 15 minutes and you wouldn't even notice, because the air temperature in your room and your house wouldn't change hardly at all. As a result, if they did that, they would again be able to reduce the load on the network. So there's things you could do with technology which could do, and you could do it yourself. I mean, right now, I've got a property a couple of hours from here. I've got a generator and I've got a PV system because it's off the grid. I can, on my iPhone today, I can literally check that battery level and turn that generator on if I need to, because the sun hasn't been shining, make sure I've got lots of electricity when I arrive. The technology's there. What we haven't been able to do as a result of not using it well is get the benefits of that technology.
And I think with technology, I mean, I can't speak for others and I won't, but for myself, I'm not terribly adventurous at getting to understand it. So if it's not super simple in front of me, I won't use it. But if my retailer is saying to me, with this technology, we can do this, that 15-minute cycle of your air conditioner by remote, so I don't know about it, it's happening, I've agreed to it, I've ticked a box, how much significant pressure might that take off the grid, and how would that actually forestall them needing to build more poles and wires?
Well, again, all of these things would add up. To be able to say that any specific one would generate a particular outcome is a bit less clear, but we do know that from all the trials that have been done in Australia and elsewhere, the use of sharper pricing signals and critical peak pricing on average can result in a reduction in peak demand of about 20% or even more. Now, that's pretty significant and it's worth going after.
So why aren't we doing it already if we know that? I mean, on the face of it, I imagine the answer is there's winners and losers, and when you've got losers, you've got governments who are reluctant to take steps. I mean, why haven't we done this?
I think part of it, we did have that bad experience with the introduction of smart meters in Victoria, which people are still recovering from. And I think as we get through the next phase, we'll see that maybe these things can help us operate our electricity system a lot more cleverly. I think the political leaders have been very loath to address these issues. And I think to some extent, the regulatory structure has been slow. The businesses themselves would say that they've tried a few things, some of which have worked, some of which haven't. But again, the state governments in particular have been very loath to allow them to be more flexible, to be more innovative. And, you know, I mean, many people, because of the experience with rising prices, are justifiably suspicious that any of these changes could be for the good. Because most of us, when they see the word change, they think change is going to be bad. They don't really think that maybe change could actually be good. So I think it's going to be hard. I don't think the technology side of this, the capacity to do it, is there now today as a result of the things we're talking about. I think it's going to be a combination of support from the community, say, yeah, look, if we can get fairer, cheaper prices, we'll go along with this. And then the energy companies have got to respond to this, the regulatory bodies have got to support it. But I think we're starting to see enough frustration with this, the high prices we've been paying, to say we need to change, and this is one of the changes.
This that goes to another question from the floor. The system, this is the question that came in, the system seems unfair in that companies are benefiting at the expense of consumers, particularly low-income consumers. Does the system need to be changed? What might be a new economic model that moves beyond the current grid concept?
Well, that's another. I mean, there are some long-term issues as to the way the grid's going to work. I think one of the interesting things about this particular move that we're talking about is that when you look at the data, it's actually low-income people who are more likely to benefit from the sort of changes we're talking about. So some analysis that was done by the South Australian Council for Social Services, they suggested that if we change towards the capacity tariff structure we're describing, something like 80% of people on low incomes would benefit immediately without doing anything at all. Just would be automatically fairer. And then about 90% would benefit if they then had access to, if they didn't change their behaviour in response to better pricing signals. Now, that doesn't mean there won't be.
Well, I was going to say, what about this person who is ill or is elderly, who's at home, has to have the air conditioner on during the hot days because they just can't suffer it, or they've got an illness, which means they can't, or they're running some kind of equipment because of their illness. They don't really have the opportunity to turn off that equipment or do without the aircon.
Well, two things about that. One is if they are in that situation, most likely they've got that system on most days, most of those days, most of the summer, for example. So again, they wouldn't have a very peaky load, and so they would again most likely be people who would be benefiting. But in addition to that, If there are people who are in particular circumstances where A, they're on low incomes, and or B, they might have some particular problem with their health or whatever that requires them to use electricity in that way you've described, Fran, then we're better off targeting that and saying, look, we already have support mechanisms for people who are in difficult circumstances. Those people do certainly need to get help to manage these sort of changes. That by itself is not enough to say we shouldn't do this, because overwhelmingly most people would benefit, particularly people on low incomes would benefit. For those people, few people who might be adversely affected, what we need to do is make sure they're protected and they're not adversely affected.
You've mentioned, you know, regulatory things and retailers trying a few things. What about solar PV? Because a lot of Australians have now installed solar PV panels. Some are making money selling electricity actually back into the grid. And again, a question from the floor, what's the real cost of solar PV compared with alternatives? And how are solar PV users getting an unfair advantage, or are they getting an unfair advantage?
Well, again, the devil will be in the detail of how people use a solar PV system and to some extent whereabouts in Australia you live. But when you think about the way a solar PV system works, you stick it on the roof of your house, and basically during the middle of the day, on a bright sunny day, particularly in winter when the temperature is a bit cooler actually, these things produce quite a bit of electricity. Most likely for many people they're at work, so it's sending electricity into the grid and you're being paid for that. It doesn't, depending again on where you are in Australia, it may not actually reduce the peak quite as much. It could reduce the peak a bit, it may shift a little, but often by the time people come home from work and school and so often and start really cranking up their electricity demand, the actual PV system is starting to fall away. So as a result of that, you're not getting as good alignment as you could. So what's happening is that the person who's put in that PV system, they're reducing their average consumption, but again, they're not necessarily reducing their peak load quite so much.
Tony Wood, the Energy Program Director at the Grattan Institute, in conversation with Fran Kelly, host of RN Breakfast. How much do you pay for your electricity, and can power pricing be made fairer for everyone? As usual, you can share your views on the Big Ideas website at abc.net.au/RN. Tomorrow on Big Ideas, how far away is a cure for dementia? I'm Paul Barclay. Bye for now.
We're alert and quite possibly alarmed. As the country moves to a new terror footing, we ask the Sunday Extra Outsiders to chew over the state of national insecurity. We wondered whether mandatory detention has just been scuttled by the High Court, and argue the merits of the Pine Plan for higher education. And then we held a First Dog on the Moon Royal Commission. The Sunday Extra podcast. You can stream or download it at the RN website.